I have a message from another time. Airy Productions Unlimited presents Undocumented Features, Future Imperfect, Symphony of the Sword, Number 2. First movement, This Old Dorm, by Benjamin D. Hutchins, that's me, with Pearson Moy and Chris Overstreet. Monday, May 9th, 2405, 7:33 a.m., Port Gerardar, Gerardo, Bajor System. Had there been any justice, the first morning of the Duelist Society's life on Gerardo would have dawned with the bright, golden light of promise and hope. Instead, it rained. The light coming through the windows of the little downtown hotel called the Gerardar Arms was dim and gray, not very much unlike the average climate of Worcester. The actual weather, however, was not Worcester-like at all, as spring made one valiant effort to hold on against the approaching Gerardo summer, and wind and rain pelted the windows. Some of the duelists found that rather restful. In her bed in room 202, Caitlin Hutchins looked positively blissful as she lay curled up, the scrabbling of the rain against her windowpane sculpting her dreams into nostalgic reminiscences of the great Avalon nor'easters that would roll in off Lake Daniels in the fall. Others, on the other hand, found that the whistling wind and rattling windows made it nearly impossible to sleep. The nearly in this case was Harcourt M. McKenzie. Mac had, for some strange reason, decided to leave the hotel room he shared with Jacron and Moose. The hotel wasn't large enough for individual, or even double, occupancy for all its guests. At one in the local morning to take the castle's internal measurements. Awakened by thunder at 4:30, Jacron had noted his roommate's absence, trotted up to the castle, and hauled Mac, his datapad, and his notes back to the hotel just ahead of the first real downpour. Now, at 2 hours past dawn, Moose worked to wring a breakfast out of the kitchenette's meager supplies, while Jacron sat in silence studying the Book of Jaquan, occasionally glancing up to note Mac's dead-to-the-world sprawling slumber. Jacron glanced up from his book at the first timid knock at the door. Setting down the book carefully, he stood up, stretched, and worked his way around Mac's cot to the door. After a second of peeping through the spy hole, he muttered, "Gray uniform. It's from Mac." "It would be," Moose said. "I'll see if I can wake him." As Jacron greeted the courier in the hall, a lieutenant with a CFMF Charlemagne shoulder patch and black hair with a large upward spike that defied the rain's attempts to mat it down, Moose stepped over to the cot and gently shook Mac's shoulder. "Awaken, Sleeping Beauty," he said. "Your princess has arrived." Mac mumbled something that, if intelligible, was probably unprintable. Otherwise he made no sign of movement. "Mac," Moose said a little louder, "wake up. You have a visitor." This time there wasn't even a mumble. "If you do not wake up this very minute, Mac," Moose said, standing up to his full height and nearly clocking himself on the light fixture, "I am quite liable to sit on you." One squinted eye peered up from the pillow.
"It's no reason to be rude,"
Mac mumbled, slowly gathering his limbs in from the four points of the compass and drawing himself up into a sitting position.
"Oh, coffee."
Mac's brown hair, rumpled more than his usual neglect, sat atop the head of a young man who had already decided that sunrises are horrible things to see live. His bleary eyes squinted as he tried to bring the gray-clad form of Lieutenant Tetsuo Selin into focus. "Midshipman McKenzie?" she asked, shuffling her way uncertainly into the room.
"Commission's inactive. Need coffee,"
Mac grunted, rubbing his head. "I have a personal message for you from Admiral Nakajima," Lieutenant Selin said, handing a printout over to Mac. "She would have calmed you, but the weather's knocked out the town's comm receivers." Mac blinked at Selin, then looked at the paper in his hands. "Need coffee," he said in his first clear voice of the day. I need very strong coffee.
I'll just rebrew the first pot, then, Moose sighed.
Looking at Selin, he added,
I hope you're not upset by this. He's had a rough night.
I've served under Admiral Nakajima for 3 years, Selin smiled. I'm used to it, although she can't stand coffee.
Mac sat in his cot, his head still fogged in, while Jacron said his goodbyes to Lieutenant Selin for him. A few minutes later, Moose scooped a cupful of rebrewed coffee from the pot and gave it to Mac, who drank it black without a blink. A few seconds later, the fog lifted, and Mac could focus his eyes on the paper for the first time.
Midshipman Harcourt Mackenzie, care of the Gerardar Arms, 112 Center Street, Port Gerardar, Republic of Bajor.
Hi! It turns out I'm going to be separated from my task force for a few months. Task Force 6 is going into dry dock for a fleet-wide refit to install metadrive units and replace the old engines on all the CFMF's ships. We'll be a lot faster with the new engines. Can't tell you how much. It's classified.
Did she really type a smiley face? Moose asked. I thought only schoolgirls and text-based comp heads did that.
My chief engineer, Shran, is going to remain with the ships to supervise the refit. He says he can get you a summer job on CFA Bethlehem as assistant working on the Charlemagne's refit. I figure if you're going to study something as boring as space architecture anyway, you ought to get some practical experience when you can.
Don't worry, this won't involve a reactivation of your commission, just offering a civilian job, take it or leave it. We'll have you back at Bajor in plenty of time for your school's reopening ceremonies, and we'll put in a good word with your instructors for extra credit.
Gotta go. I've been temporarily assigned as CFMF liaison to the B-5 project, since I'm ranking officer in the area once Terry Curtis leaves. Moving office from Charlemagne to B-5 sucks! But Derek throws great parties. See you in the fall. Aya!
Mac frowned, staring at the letter he'd just finished reading aloud.
More coffee, he said at last. It's on the burner, Moose sighed. You're awake now, you can get it yourself. The walk will do you good.
As Mac trod to the kitchenette, Moose read the letter for himself.
I think you'd be ecstatic about this. It's a chance to try out the field of your dreams.
Mac gulped a swallow of neutron black coffee and frowned a bit deeper.
The Freespacer home fleet leaves the Bajor system for Zeta Cygni the day after B-5's official opening ceremonies, he said. I'll be completely out of reach until mid-August. Won't be able to help with the castle.
Is that why you were out so late last night? Jacron asked.
Mac nodded.
Got pretty good measurements of the first floor, he said. Send my notes. Be sure Caitlin gets 'em.
He took a sip of coffee and added, in a softly angry tone,
Yesterday I borrowed money from my dad to buy a full set of construction tools for working on the castle. A few hundred marks worth.
How much in salcreds? Moose asked.
About, maybe 500 credits, Mac sighed.
A complete set, torches, turbo spanners, the whole sausage.
But you can use those on the job, right?
Mac sighed. In a very small voice, he added,
I had to promise my father that I would take the ship master's test this week to get the money. I've been putting it off for 3 years now.
On this job, he went on, pointing at the paper, I wouldn't be using any tools. Helpers fetch tools, or borrow 'em from others. They're not trained labor. Even if I did need the tools, the pay from 3 months of construction work is more than enough to pay for the tools, even at helper's wages.
They pay that well?
They work that hard.
Refit jobs aren't like new construction contracts. They're crash programs. You work 10 hours a day, 7 days a week, without fail. If the parts for the main refit aren't available, they find something for you to fix or replace. Although...
Mac paused a moment, calculating in his head.
4.5 marks an hour after room and board allotment. Call it
7 sal creds an hour. 900 hours, and Dad doesn't expect any payment till after I graduate. 6,300 sal creds. 5,600 after the fleet tithe. Mac. Gerardo to Mac. Moose shook Mac's arm, knocking him out of his mental calculations. Sorry. Anyway, of course I'll be going. It is my career, after all. But I did want to work on the castle with the rest of you. Mac sighed, picking up a set of clean clothes and heading for the bathroom. It's probably better this way, though. I won't get on everyone's nerves this way. I have this tendency to obsess sometimes.
Perish the thought, said Moose. I've never noticed, said Jacron.
Mac shrugged, his tongue exhausted from the unusually long workout, and stepped into the shower. As the water began to run, Moose looked at Jacron and vice versa, and both breathed a deep but carefully quiet sigh of relief.
Is he that bad with your guitar lessons? Jacron asked.
Worse, Moose said. Once he's determined to do something, he doesn't let go easily, and it takes a brick to the head to distract him.
Yes, Jacron nodded. A very large brick.
But a very fine gentleman, nonetheless.
One of the finest.
Wouldn't hear a word against him.
Nor I.
But it does take one hell of a brick.
Perhaps even two hells, Jacron agreed.
Besides, Moose said with a shrug, I'll be leaving not long after him. It's a long way back to Hoffman, and Mom expects me for her birthday. I probably won't be back until A-term myself. What about you?
Oh, I'll be staying, for the moment at least, Jacron smiled. I have some family coming to the Babylon Station whom I haven't seen in years. It will be good to spend some time together this summer. I will have to get home, yes, but not immediately.
Moose nodded. Looking in the kitchen at the tiny breakfast he'd managed to cobble together, and the coffee nobody but Mac would ever drink, he sighed.
Would you consider waiving your religious views for a day and getting a late breakfast before we see Mac to the shuttle?
Ten:45 a.m. Ryan Matthews Memorial Spaceport, New Avalon, Zeta Cygni. Janice Barlow had encountered several historical figures in recent days, most of them connected in some way to the cadre of immortals who had founded the Wedge Defense Force back in the late 20th century. As she stood in one of the smaller starship revetments at Matthews Memorial, however, she reflected that she had never before met one who was so scruffy-looking. Zefram Cochrane was one of the great heroes of human space travel. He'd invented warp drive, which had revolutionized military and exploratory starship propulsion once he and a couple of friends from the WDF had made it practical. He'd made great advances in astrogation techniques for deep space exploration, dramatically improved the performance of subetheric radio, and was one of the key developers of matter transportation technology. He was the chief discoverer of metaspace and the inventor of the metaspace transition point generator. And he was one disreputable-looking individual on a Monday morning, grizzled, rumpled, unshaven, and a bit squinty-eyed. With an unlit cigar clamped in the corner of his mouth and a New Avalon Knights baseball cap crammed down backward on his head, he looked more like a janitor than the inventor of fully half the ways in which the people of the galaxy traveled between stars. He was personable enough, though. He shook her hand firmly as he said in a somewhat reedy voice, "Hey, how are you? You must be Griffin's latest prodigy, the Barlow kid, right? Zefram Cochrane, pleased to meet you. Friends call me Zed." Releasing her hand, Cochrane started prowling around the Rubicon, taking it in from different angles. "Pretty good shape for a Block 1," he said. "Transport for some government bigwig?" Janice nodded. "Psycor Regional Enforcement Director," she said. Cochrane's eyebrows went up, and he gave a low whistle. "Sweet," he remarked. "How do you get a hold of her?"
A couple friends and I liberated it during all the confusion.
Cochran grinned.
Good for you, he said, and slapped the side of the runabout. Griff wants her upgraded to Kennebec class. We'll try not to touch the interior any more than we have to, he added, waggling his eyebrows.
Okay, cool. Any idea when you'll be done?
5, maybe 6 weeks. We'll let you know. In the meantime, good luck with training, said Cochran.
He keyed open the main hatch, stepped inside, and waved goodbye as the hatch closed again behind him.
Weird guy, Janice observed to Mitra, her ever-faithful, ever-hovering Mag.
I kinda like him.
She turned, activated the anti-grav cart her luggage was on, and headed for the subway station. 6 hours later, she was walking through the corridors of Building C, residence block, of the Experts of Justice training facility outside the city. Of the city itself, she'd seen nothing yet, so busy was she with forms and introductory materials. She'd barely had time for lunch with all the things she had to do to assume her summer internship as an IPO field agent. Now, though, she was at liberty, and as soon as she settled into her quarters, she planned to go back to the end station and head into New Avalon to see the sights. She found the appropriate room, 117, punched the entry code into the door and stepped inside, where she promptly tripped over something lying on the floor just inside the threshold and fell with a heavy, rather painful whomp onto what felt like a large, lumpy rock.
Ow!
She announced, rolling off whatever it was and sitting up to get a better look. It did indeed appear to be a rock, roughly oblong, about 5 feet long by 2 feet wide by 8 inches high, lumpy and mottled in grays and blues. Kind of pretty for a big lumpy rock that had no reason to be here.
Who the hell, she continued in the same irate tone, left this big freaking rock in here?
Ow, replied the rock in a sardonic tone of voice. Who the hell let this clumsy freaking primate in here?
Janice blinked. She said.
I guess, replied the rock dryly, you've never seen a horta before.
A whata? Said Janice.
Horta.
Horta.
Janice got up, brushed herself off, and went to the data terminal by the desk.
Computer?
Working, replied the computer.
Horta?
Horta, said the computer promptly. Sentient silicon-based life form native to Yanis 6, Rigel Sector. Matriarchal Society, Horta League. Federation member since 2375. First contact officers, Captain James T. Kirk, Commander Spock, USS Enterprise, NCC-1701. Available biometric, ecological, and cultural data is extensive.
Thanks.
The computer beeped acknowledgement and fell silent. Janice sat down at the desk and regarded the rock for a moment. Now that she got a better look at it, she could see the little cybernetic vocoder built into its upper shell.
Sorry about tripping over you and calling you a freaking rock, she said with a wry grin.
The Horta shuffled around slightly. In the coming weeks, Janice would come to learn that constituted a shrug.
My fault for lying in front of the door, it replied. I thought you'd be arriving tomorrow. It seems we're to be roommates. My name is Carrot.
Janice Barlow, she said. And this is Mitra, she added, indicating the football-sized, and roughly shaped, critter hovering timidly behind her right shoulder.
I think he's worried that you'll eat him.
He does look somewhat appetizing, the Horta replied dryly. But I think I can restrain myself. Without a facial expression, or, for that matter, a face, to go on, Janice couldn't be sure yet if the creature was joking. But she chose to believe it was, and laughed.
This was going to be interesting.
Thursday, May 12th, 2405, 2:45 p.m., Gerardo.
The Wedge Defense Force Corps of Engineers starship Feng Shui, a Vitruvius-class construction ship, was nearly the size of a Macross-class superdimensional fortress. It dwarfed many modern ships of the line, and was easily the biggest ship that had ever, to anyone's knowledge, orbited the Bajoran moon Jurato. For all that, though, the Feng Shui was not a mighty vessel in the same sense that the old Wayward Sun had been. Though fairly heavily armored and shielded, she was lightly armed, unmaneuverable, and very slow. Her role was not to do battle, but rather to deliver a battalion of engineers, all their equipment, and supplies enough to build and fortify a decent-sized planetary base to any location in the galaxy, then stand by, support them, and give them a place to live while they did their work. In the last 3 days, the population of Jurato had doubled, and before all was said and done, it would double again, all temporarily, of course. The WDF Corps of Engineers wouldn't be staying all that long. They had a job to finish up by the end of the summer. For the last 3 days, Caitlin Hutchins and her friends had spent their afternoons sitting on the steps of the great castle-like stone building at the corner of what was to become the campus of the Steedlitz Satori Mandeville Memorial Institute, and watched the engineers prepare the site. They'd cut back the forest to make room for the buildings, roads, and pathways, but not by clear-cutting the entire area. The campus was designed to be a part of the site's landscape, not superimposed upon it. Another detachment was working on the road to Port Gerardar, the moon's biggest settlement, population 2,500, which was situated a couple of miles from the school, on the opposite shore of the small lake which separated the hills of the building site from the craggy mountains on the western horizon. The whole area was alive with the rumble of heavy construction equipment, the shouts of workers, and the cheeping of communicators. Kate and her friends had been students at the Worcester Preparatory Institute on Earth, but thanks to a little misunderstanding with the local government, that institute no longer existed, and Kate and her friends found themselves distinctly unwelcome within the borders of the Earth Alliance for the time being. So it was just as well that the administration and most of the faculty of their old school had taken Kate's father up on his proposal that they establish a new school here. As Kate sat watching a COE earth mover flatten part of a nearby hill for the foundation of what was to be the physics building, she noticed a flash of color moving up the larger hill upon which the castle stood, the familiar splash of bright pink that could only mean her roommate and best friend, Utrinatenjo, was approaching. Sure enough, here she came, a roll of paper in her hand, flushed with victory after her visit to the temporary office building the engineers had erected from which to manage the site.
"You got 'em?" asked Kate.
Utrina grinned and spread the rolled paper out upon the steps. Major Clanton wasn't using the printer just now. When not hanging around on the steps of the old castle and watching the engineers work, the Institute Duelist Society had spent much of their time aboard the starship Challenger, Kate's father's command, working with a couple of his officers on a plan for the reconstruction of the castle. It had been abandoned for hundreds, perhaps thousands of years, and though structurally sound, it lacked utilities or even a roof, except for the great bronze dome in the center, and the interior needed a complete overhaul. The WDF Corps of Engineers couldn't get involved in that. Their charter specifically prohibited them from modifying or interfering with in any way an artifact of an ancient culture. And the castle was certainly that. It predated, so far as anyone knew, the colonization of Jurato by Bajorans. The castle was to be one of the corners of the DSM campus, but aside from landscaping a bit around it, the engineers couldn't involve themselves with it. The duelists, on the other hand, were under no such restriction, and they had expressed permission from the local authorities, in the form of Vedic Barile Antos, the religious leader under whose authority Jurato fell, and Prilar Otano Lompoc, the head of the local monastery whose lands the campus occupied, to rebuild the old structure into their new home and headquarters. Plans for the reconstruction of the duelists' castle, as it had become known, had proceeded quickly. The duelists were talented students,
Were they not, they would never have been attending WPI in the first place. And with the aid of Lieutenant Tevek, the Challenger's chief of security and an avid amateur home improver, and Nadia Davian, the ship's chief engineer, they had made great progress in developing solid plans for their summer's work. Uchna, the Society's vice president, carried those plans with her on a data crystal in the pocket of the scarlet-trimmed black jacket she nearly always wore. And now, with the aid of Major Hiram Clanton, the commander of the 3rd Battalion, WDF Corps of Engineers, she had just made proper printouts of them. At last, the Society had blueprints in hand. Now all they needed were materials and tools. "You guys look these over and make sure they're okay," said Utrina. "I'll catch a shuttle up to B-5, beam over to Challenger, and let the chief know we're ready to start taking deliveries."
"You could just call him, you know," said Kate with a little smile.
"Sure, I could," said Utrina, "but then I wouldn't get to play with Wolfgang. I'll be back for dinner time, most likely." The general duelist consensus to their VP was, "Have fun," as she turned and trotted off down the hill. It was a pleasant half-hour's walk around the lake to Port Geradar, where the orbital shuttle station, instantly nicknamed the bus stop, was located. Utrina, who had become something of a celebrity in the little town already for her repeated trips up and down, smiled and waved at people as she made her way through the narrow streets to the station. The building, modern plasticrete and transparisteel, looked somewhat out of place amid the oddly angled walls and pale stucco of the Bajoran dwellings that made up most of the town. She entered, whistling a happy tune, and stopped short as she noticed something rather unusual. There was a girl, probably a year or two younger than Utrina, sitting on the bench in the station's small waiting room. She was dressed in faded jeans with threadbare knees, a somewhat crumpled, frost-proof shirt that was looking thin at the elbows, and old Chuck Taylors with mostly flat soles. She had dusky skin, brown hair, and a page boy, and, most unusual of all, at least for the setting, the distinctive ridged forehead of a Klingon. The most common Klingon language, known in its own terms only as the Klingon language, and almost universally known outside the Empire as Klingonese, had possessed no real greetings before 2300. It was a very brusque language, given more to threats and imprecation than social niceties. Still, centuries of interaction with politer species had impressed upon the Klingons the need for such things, at least to make conversations with outlanders go more smoothly. And so the Klingon Language Institute on Konos, the homeworld, had adapted a few standard expressions, like good morning and greetings and so forth, into common phrases. There was still no word for howdy, but at least now a Klingon speaker could have a semblance of civility. "Good afternoon," said Utrina to the Klingon girl in her best schoolgirl Klingonese. "Are you lost?" "Mind your own damn business," the girl snapped back in standard, scowling. Utrina blinked, then raised her hands in surrender. "Sorry," she said. "Just trying to be friendly." "It's impossible to be friendly in Klingon Hull," grumbled the girl. "Only an idiot would try." "Well, I'm sorry," Utrina replied with a conciliatory smile. "I don't know Vulcan." The Klingon girl gave her an odd look, then folded her arms and looked somewhere else. "Okay, it was a stupid joke. Cut me some slack, huh? I didn't mean to offend you." Utrina sat down on the bench, pulled up one of her feet, and regarded the Klingon girl over her knee. "Have you got a name? I'm Utrina Tenjo." "Belana Torres," replied the girl reluctantly. "Torres." Now there was a Klingon surname unlike any Utrina had encountered before. Admittedly, she was only a first-year student of the language and its accompanying culture, and the real intricacies of Klingon family naming customs were well beyond her grasp at the moment, but still, that sounded almost like a human name. She shrugged it off and, still trying to break the ice, said, "So,
Belana. What brings you to Gerardo? You're a long way from home.
I heard there was a construction job here, said Belana sullenly, but the WDF Corps of Engineers wouldn't hire me. They said I'm too young.
How old are you?
13. Why? Are you some kind of cop?
As a reserve officer in the International Police Space Force, Utena realized she would have been perfectly justified in replying, yes. That didn't strike her as the wisest answer, and anyway, it would have been mainly an act of smartassery. So instead, she shook her head and said, just curious, that's all. You have to admit, it's kind of odd to see a teenage Klingon waiting for an orbital shuttle on Gerardo.
I'm not a Klingon, Belana muttered.
Uh-huh, said Utena. Okay, you're not a Klingon. Fine. It's kind of odd to see a teenage anything waiting for an orbital shuttle on Gerardo.
You are, said Belana, looking ever more annoyed.
True, Utena replied equably, but then I'm kind of odd. So anyway, where are you headed now?
The girl who was not a Klingon shrugged.
Babylon 5, I guess, she said. Maybe I'll join the Free Spacers before their fleet leaves.
Utena might have commented on the advisability or inadvisability of that move, but before she could do so, she was interrupted by a loud sound. There was a rather awkward silence.
When was the last time you had something to eat? Utena inquired conversationally.
I don't know, 2-3 days? Belana replied, trying hard to sound unconcerned.
Well, I'm not going to tell you what to do, said Utena airily, because I'm sure you can take care of yourself. And I'm not going to offer you charity, because I'm sure you've got your pride and all.
Thanks, said Belana dryly.
On the other hand, if you were to just randomly decide to skip this shuttle and walk around to the other side of the lake, up to that big old nifty-looking castle building the engineers are staying away from, and tell the brown-haired girl with glasses and a stutter that I sent you, she might introduce you to an MRE. Not out of pity or anything, you understand, but just to be neighborly.
Uh-huh, Belana replied skeptically. And if you like construction, well, that old castle needs a lot of work, and the Corps of Engineers can't touch it, so we're doing it all ourselves. And we could always use more hands, especially since our Hoffmanite bailed on us, the bastard. His mother's birthday, she said, rolling her eyes with mock scorn in her voice. Please.
Belana glanced sidelong at Utena, one eyebrow raised, and said nothing. Utena put her hands behind her head, stretched her body like a bow, and then relaxed, looking up at the ceiling.
You know, she said, as if talking to herself and not relating any relevant information to any other person, I've got a real weakness for the lost puppy type.
Belana studied her for a few long seconds, then got up and shouldered her duffel bag.
You're weird, she informed the pink-haired duelist, then turned and scampered from the shuttle station.
Utena smiled up at the plasticrete ceiling.
I know, she told the empty room.
Caitlin and the other duelists were doing what, in construction circles, is lightly termed site preparation. In the case of the old temple, or whatever it really was, that involved clearing out a lot of debris. In between design sessions with Nadia and Tevek, they'd been swamping junk, fallen plaster, moldering old leaves, animal nests, and other assorted detritus out of the building for several days now, and as they made progress, what they found was encouraging. The building's interior wasn't as bad off as they'd initially thought. Most of the interior walls were the same beautiful red and gold stone as the outside. They'd thought it gray at first sight, but as it turned out, it had just desperately needed a power washing, and proved to be just as sturdy. As Kate had toured it, room by arduously cleared room,
She and the others had mapped the place and taken their best guesses as to what the various rooms were used for. The ground floor contained a great entrance hall, which was actually 2 stories high for most of the front half of the building. There had been grand staircases on both sides, but now there was only one. Behind this, the first floor had what the students took for kitchens, storage areas, a library perhaps, and what appeared to have been, they thought, a ballroom. The second floor, that part of it that wasn't the continuation of the great hall, contained a number of quite small, mostly featureless rooms that almost looked like detention cells. That, so far, was as far as they'd made it. Kate sat on the steps, frowning thoughtfully with the plans for their renovations spread out on her lap, wondering when Utina was going to get back and explain the mysterious Klingon girl who'd bummed an MRE and was now helping Sionji muck out the northeast corner of the third floor. A shadow fell across the blueprints. Goodness, another one? She thought, and looked up. Standing over her was a girl in her middle-late teens, tall and rangy, dressed in an iridescent green coverall with a sort of sleeveless tabard belted over it. Embroidered on her chest was a symbol, 3 interlocked green triangles. From the belt of her tabard hung a number of tools and instruments, and she had a canvas tool bag slung over one shoulder. She had very pale skin, an aquiline nose, and no hair. Instead, from the back of her head, she sported a tidily crenellated ridge of grayish-white bone. Kate blinked, then rolled up the blueprints, jumped to her feet, and cried, "Chanan!" "You started without me!" cried the Minbari girl in a lightly accented tone of mock indignation. Then she caught Kate up in a hug, careful not to bruise her friend with any of the various tools hanging from her belt, backed up, and said, "Let me see what kind of trouble you've got planned." Kate grinned, and the two of them sat down on the steps to spread out the blueprints and talk them over. Presently another shadow crossed the paper, and they looked up to see Sionji, smudged and rumpled, and the mystery girl, what's-her-name, something, looking pleased with themselves. "The rooms on the third floor are bigger," said the Klingon girl, who looked markedly more cheerful than she had when she'd arrived. "We think they're probably bedrooms." "Or at least they can be," Sionji added, nodding. Having delivered himself of his report, he seemed to notice that Kate was with someone, someone he didn't recognize to boot, and he paused, looking a bit puzzled. Kate smiled. "This is Chanan," she said, indicating the Minbari girl. "She was a junior last year." Chanan stood up, brushed off the knees of her coveralls, and said, "I had to go home Christmas time when the Grey Council yanked my passport." She sounded rather annoyed about it. "Judging by Network 23, I missed all the excitement." Kate sighed. "You don't know the half of it," she said. "Chanan, this is Kyuichi Sionji. You remember him. Week before Christmas, he tried to kill Utina and me." Sionji looked mildly embarrassed. "I wasn't well," he offered by way of explanation. "Ah," said Chanan. "And this," said Sionji, "is our mystery guest." "Belana Torres," said Belana. "I'm just sort of passing through." Chanan glanced around. "Gerardo is a weird place to be passing through," she observed. "So people keep saying," replied Belana, frowning. "Okay," said Sionji. "Back to work. You've earned your lunch. Now it's time to get started earning supper. Pleasure to meet you, Chanan." Chanan grinned. "Yeah, you do." As they left, she hunkered down by the plans again. "Cute guy for a human psychopath," she noted. "He grows on you," Kate agreed, nodding absently. Utina returned shortly before the duelists gathered and adjourned to the Jaradar Arms in Port Jaradar,
where they were staying until the castle's interior was something approaching inhabitable. On the walk back to town, Kate introduced Chenan around to those who hadn't had a chance to meet her. Utina handled the remaining introductions to her bus station foundling. Chenan looked interested when Kate introduced her to Mia Ausa.
"Hmm," she said. "Ausa, that's a Minbari name."
"My mother was Minbari," said Mia, nodding.
"Interesting," said Chenan. "What caste are you?"
The question seemed to flick a switch inside Mia's head and deactivate her good mood. It brought an instant frown to her face.
"Neither," she replied sourly.
Chenan looked enlightened.
"Ah," she said.
Then, smiling a little maliciously, she added airily,
"So you're a worker, like me."
Mia blanched, then blushed, the ebb and flow of color in her face making for quite a show against her pale white skin, one of her birthrights from her Minbari mother.
I'm, she stammered.
"I don't get it," said Bilana Torres.
"Oh, well, you see, Bilana," said Chenan in a cheerily instructive tone, "Minbari society is divided into three castes. The religious caste, who pontificate on high and look down their noses at the rest of the universe. The warrior caste, who polish their weapons and prepare for a war that ended 2,000 years ago. And the worker caste, who actually do everything."
She grinned lightly and added,
"The prayers and the fighters have a tendency to forget about that last part."
Mia sputtered for a few moments longer, then gathered herself, stopped walking, and bowed her head.
"I apologize. It was a stupid, thoughtless remark."
Chenan thumped her on the shoulder.
"Forget it," she said. "Happens all the time.
Anyway, from the way you said it, it sounds like you've got an axe to grind." She blinked as if just noticing something, leaned a little closer, and took a good squint at the silver-mounted, opalescent gem Mia wore on her lapel.
"Very interesting," she added. "I've heard of those, but never actually seen one before. Is it real?"
Mia drew herself up.
"Of course it's real," she replied, slightly stuffily. "You never can tell nowadays," Chenan replied, shrugging.
The two of them, and Bilana, who had stopped with them as she seemed to find their entire interaction fascinating, started walking again, following the others. Chenan went on,
"Some people have a really weird idea of what's funny.